Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
All right. Hey, guys, this is Toby Mathis with the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast. I am lucky today to have William Rind on. Welcome, William.
Thank you, Toby. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and William's kind of a rock star in the securities world. You started Granite Shares, right?
That's right. Yeah, I founded the company 4 years ago. So we went live with our first funds 3 years ago, actually last month. So been doing it a few years now.
Fantastic. And so first off, these are ETFs that you create, right? That you're marketing And is it marketed primarily to professional grade investors like that are managing other people's money, or is it full on anybody in the market could go get these?
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of the ETF structure, Toby, is that, you know, ETFs for those that maybe, you know, don't 100% know it, it stands for exchange traded fund. And the clue is really in the name here, that it's a fund which is listed like a share on the stock exchange. So you buy it just like you would buying shares in Coca-Cola or IBM or any company that you like, except instead of buying one share of one company, you're buying a share in a fund that owns multiple companies or maybe some other asset like gold or bonds. But really, they've become this sort of new technology in the asset management space, if you will. And they're a very, very popular way for people to invest now.
Now, a lot of folks are used to the old mutual fund, and they're used to being told that that's where they're going to invest. And it seems to me that over the last few years, people are embracing ETF as a significantly low-cost alternative. Do you have any comment on that? Is that why you went to the ETF structure?
Toby, I mean, I've been doing this, you know, almost all my career. So I was a reformed investment banker. I did that for a year and a half outside of college when I first opened. Then I joined the asset management industry and sort of luckily got involved in ETFs, you know, right place, right time, you know, 20 years ago. And so I've kind of been a part of this movement for my whole career, really. And I can 100% tell you that this is, in my mind, the new technology. And I think it's easy to understand if you put it like that, and the ETF is the new technology in investing world versus a mutual fund, which is the old technology or legacy technology. And there are a few kind of fundamental advantages that ETFs bring over the traditional mutual fund, which is why they've gained so much popularity and it's now a multi-trillion dollar industry. But you know, one of the things you highlighted right off the bat there is, I think, just something that appeals clearly to everybody, which is lower costs. And typically, what ETFs have gained a reputation for is low-cost investing. So just like your Walmarts and your Amazons and your big sort of supermarkets that built a value proposition around low cost, that's pretty much what ETFs have done to investing. And so from that perspective, you know, a lot of people will name that benefit as being the principal one. But low costs and buy and sell whenever you want are probably the two that get highlighted most.
And that gives them a distinct advantage over a mutual fund where you have soft dollar costs, you have tax drag, you have liquidity requirements, things like that. Does any of that exist in an ETF?
So it depends on what the ETF strategy is. But as a general rule of thumb, you know, one of the things that ETFs do in terms of separating themselves from mutual funds is mutual funds tend to be the home of what's called active management. And obviously, active management, for the most part, was the cult of a personality, a particular team of individuals that were trying to outperform the market. And in so doing that, charging large fees to investors for the privilege. Now, obviously, after fees and most importantly, taxes, consistently, that strategy or the active management philosophy has just proved to be incredibly difficult to do. And so a lot of people went to ETFs because ETFs, for the most part, and there are actively managed ETFs, but for the most part, they're considered passive, meaning you're just getting access to a portfolio of securities that tracks or replicates an index. And so therefore, you don't have star fund managers or active management, and it just does what it says on the tin.
Yeah. So in what you just said there, it does what it says on the tin is actually really what could, can you even see what's in a mutual fund if you, when
that's
this
right.
thing actively managed, it's really hard to see what's even in there, right?
it's really, really difficult. And that's why active management, you know, if one of the major challenges for investors is what is in the portfolio, you know, what do you own? And active managers will say, well, that's my secret sauce. So if I tell you that I don't want people going out and buying these stocks themselves, because that's what you're paying me for. But obviously with an ETF, you know, one of the great benefits is complete transparency. So from a regulatory perspective, by law, we have to publish the portfolio on a daily basis. So we tell you exactly what we own, exactly what stocks, or if it's a bond fund, what bonds, or if it's gold, what gold bars. Do that on a daily basis. So it's complete transparency. So investors know on any given day what exactly they own, which, you know, fancy that.
Why would anybody do it the other way? Because just knowing what I know, yeah, in the market.
Putting their hand up and saying, I want less transparency.
Somebody who's taken the blue pill rather than the red one, right? So this is where it gets interesting, because you and I both went through 99 and the recession and 08 and all those things. And people who thought that they had a non-risk portfolio, and then they found out that they were exposed to the exact same things in the high-risk portfolio because they didn't know what the heck that was in there. It's basically just a marketing gimmick. So an ETF, I could see exactly what you're investing in.
That's right. Yeah. You go onto the website of any issuer, i.e. the fund manager, the provider. So if you go onto the Granite Shares website, for example, which is our website, you could see for each of our funds, what particular funds, I mean, what kind of underlying securities, stocks, et cetera, that we own on a daily basis. And that's the same for all providers.
And you're still looking at it on a daily basis. Like, you know, we know the market's doing all sorts of crazy stuff. It does backflips, it does high dives and all that stuff. But you're looking at it on a daily basis. This isn't where you're just like, hey, I bought it 3 years ago and I've just been letting it ride. Do you guys change out the shares? Are you still looking at when you're going to reduce a position, things like that?
Yeah, so for the most part, you know, most ETFs follow an index. Index is kind of like a set of rules that govern the way that the fund has to be managed. So it will cover things like, you know, how many shares have to be included in the fund, what types of shares are they, how often do they rebalance, which is will we change out some shares and bring in new shares. But I think the main advantage to people is that it's a recipe. So think of it like just a recipe. And what we're doing is following the recipe. So the benefit of that to the investor is you don't get any of these sort of crazy situations where you get a manager taking risk and doing something that ends up, you know, costing the fund and the investors a lot of money in terms of performance. And so we stick to what the strategy is, and the investor, when they're buying into the fund, looks at the prospectus and the fact sheet and understands exactly what it is, and therefore can follow along with the investment strategy.
And they could buy into a fund today, right? They could just get, like, if I had a Robinhood, Schwab, or any account, I can just go get Granite Shares ETF and I could just pick one, right?
Exactly right. So again, no different to any other stock that's listed in the market, that we all have ticker codes for our funds, which would be exactly the same if you're familiar with buying shares of Apple or whatever company. And so if you like gold, if you like income, if you like equities, any of the funds, they'll all have unique ticker codes. And you literally go onto your Robinhood account or your Schwab account, whatever you may do, and just you punch in that little ticker code. And there you go. You can buy shares just as easily as any other stock.
And I assume you guys get paid something to put the ETF together and to manage it, right? There's
yeah,
something.
So we, exactly. So where we get paid is what's called a management fee. And the management fee is the percentage, a small percentage of the fund's assets. And that gets calculated on an annual basis. And people can look, again, completely transparent. So most of our funds run from about, you know, 0.17 of a percent at the low end up to 0.7 of a percent at the high end in terms of management fees.
And I just want to put that in perspective, because some of these guys are used to listening to me rail on for a while, but mutual funds, according to Forbes, were somewhere between 4.8 and 5.8 when you actually calculate the actual expense of everything that's involved in a mutual fund, including those management fees, which aren't oftentimes disclosed. So you're talking about less than 1%.
Yeah, I think the average for the industry here in the United States is somewhere around 0.2, 0.3 of a percent. So it's very, very low in terms of the amount that you pay for these investments.
So why does anybody do mutual funds anymore?
I don't know is the honest answer. And I think I'll give you one sort of one answer to that, which is a real issue that people have. which is the majority of mutual fund assets are actually held in 401ks. Now, 401ks, as most of you will know, they're retirement accounts. And retirement accounts are typically offered by companies and therefore controlled by the company that you work for. And so those 401k plans have a set menu of investments that you can invest in. And over the years, the biggest and the largest mutual fund companies have kind of controlled that market. So that means that the choices that you have as an investor, if you're a worker at a big corporation or even a smaller corporation, might be pretty limited. And they might be limited just to mutual funds. And you know, all of that, you know, will change over time, but there hasn't really been that incentive to change, because the big, so long as the big mutual fund companies are controlling the plans, there's no incentive for them to move out to a lower cost investment, which means lower revenue for them. So it is happening. The good news is it's happening, but it's not happening at a rate of change that one would expect, given that ETFs, you know, for the most part, are just a superior investment offering.
Yeah. So, and again, I've had that conversation with a number of folks. Now, I tend to deal with fiduciaries, and so they tend to avoid mutual funds like the plague. But then I'll have the, I forget the name of the company, that's like an MLM, but that's, gosh, bless it. But there's a few out there where they have their salespeople aren't even necessarily securities folks. And I think they may have a securities license, but they don't actually, or they're not fiduciaries for sure. Yeah. They're usually a broker just getting paid a commission to bring people in. And I've always asked them, I said, if you could just show me what the actual expenses are, I'd be glad to actually listen to you. Otherwise, I'm just assuming that you're driving in business to your boss and that you guys are getting paid a lot of these monies off these people and they have 100% of the risk and you guys are taking most of the reward. So that can't happen in your scenario. It sounds like you guys get paid basically to create the recipe, and the cake is what the client is putting the money in, and they're getting most of the cake. They're getting 99% of the cake, 99.7% of the cake.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So ETFs are a zero commission product, which means that we don't, and I think maybe it's easier to understand in the context that we don't actually have a relationship with the end client directly, because we're disintermediated, i.e. the middleman in our case is the exchange. So the deal is we list our funds on the stock exchange and the investors buy and sell the shares from the stock exchange. And so there's a bid offer spread, just like there is for any stock, but there's not a commission in the same way that mutual funds, which obviously sell directly to the consumer or the advisor. And so from that perspective, there's no incentive to buy the product other than if it's a good product, which is the way it should be.
Yeah. Nobody's pushing you into it and saying, hey, buy this car today because you know you're on the Toyota lot and they happen to have a whole bunch of Corollas. They're not, they have no incentive to try to force you into something that they happen to be making more money on that particular day. You know what? So let's talk about the flavors of the cakes. So since we're using analogies and I'm hungry. So we have to talk about the different types of cakes. So you mentioned a couple. You had a gold, you had an income producing. What are your flavors that you have out there in these ETFs?
Yeah, so there are three things really that we do at Granite Shares as a business. So the three kind of areas of the market we like and we like to focus our efforts on. And those are real assets. So real assets, gold is our flagship fund in real asset space, but we have broad commodities, which is, as it sounds, just giving access to a broad basket of commodity futures. And then underneath that, we have platinum. So again, same as gold, just another precious metal that's different to gold. So outside of real assets, we have income. And our twist on income is we have a high income investment strategy called HIPS. HIPS stands for high income pass-through securities. And our twist on that income bucket is that a lot of people are getting income from either dividend stocks or from high yield bonds. And what we focus on is an area of the market called pass-through securities. And pass-through securities are just entities that don't pay corporate tax. So most popular ones would be things like real estate investment trusts or REITs, master limited partnerships, MLPs, BDCs or business development companies, or closed-end funds. And so that's an area of the market where they have an advantage from an income perspective already because they don't pay corporate tax. So they must distribute almost all of their income to investors. And we create a diversified portfolio of those securities that gives you a very high yield that's paid monthly. So that's income. And the last thing we do is we do large cap equity investing, but we have a completely unique take on it. So our take on is, remember the active management we were talking about? We don't like that because that involves discretion, involves human error, and it doesn't work consistently over time. So that's the science, the philosophy of picking winners. Picking winners has been proven by many, many people to be incredibly difficult to do. And that's why the vast majority of active managers underperform. And then you have index replication, which is, again, the philosophy of just owning the market, accepting underperformance, but paying very little for it. That's the trade-off you're making, saying, I'll accept the returns of the market, but in doing so, I'm giving up my chance to outperform, so I'm not going to pay anything for it. So you're very, very low cost. Our twist is we think it might actually be easier to outperform the market by actually not focusing on picking winners, but by excluding losers. And so we have a strategy called X Out. And the science behind it is actually what a lot of people maybe might not realize is that the vast majority of the return that comes from the stock market, major indices that you'll be familiar with, such as the Dow or the S&P, et cetera, comes actually only from a small handful of stocks. So you think about when you're looking at the market and the market's up 300 points or it's up 1% or 2%, it's up 10% year to date. Well, actually, when you think about the composition of that 10%, it's only a few companies that are driving it. Most people own those companies anyway. What we're focused on is getting rid of the companies that are detracting from that performance. And we do that through the lens of technological disruption. So we want to own the companies that are fundamentally advantaged by technology and exclude those that are disadvantaged. And that's our take on equity investing.
And how have you guys been doing? Like, are your funds all doing pretty successful?
Yeah, I mean, so far, obviously the real asset space has been very, very popular. Gold, as you might imagine, is incredibly popular.
It's because they're printing cash as fast. Like, how much cash have they printed in the last, have they jumped?
Trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
Trillions in direct, and then in terms of unfunded or promises, there's trillions more. We just actually crossed $1 billion in our gold ETF, just alone, actually, the last couple of days. So we've really seen demand for gold accelerate. And then in terms of the X Out strategy, which is the equity fund, we've been outperforming the market, fortunately, since this since inception, but throughout this crisis, we've outperformed. Obviously, that's no guarantee to future performance, but for those that are interested, it seems to be working so far. And then income, again, we've been able to produce that steady income for investors that pays out monthly. And so while the underlying portfolio was affected by the market, just like everything else, what it did was increase the level of income. So for people that are needing income, it's an opportunity now to buy where you get a higher income than before because of that, the falling value of the underlying portfolio.
You've mentioned gold, but what's the most popular thing that you see people running into in the crises? Because we've seen these patterns before, and I'm always interested to see what you guys are seeing from the institutional side is, where are people taking their money? Are they turning it into cash? Are they going into the gold? Are they going into some income producing? Are they scared to death that the market just keeps blowing up and it keeps going up and up and up and up and up? And like, what are you seeing?
I think from what we see, it's undoubtedly gold is kind of the biggest thing from our perspective. However, if we look back to the last crisis, income was a big one after the crisis. And people use that opportunity after 2008 to buy income assets that had been beaten up in the crisis. And so people went out and bought high yielding income investments and took advantage of those depressed prices as things like the mortgage market have been beaten up. And so I think hopefully we'll see something like that this time around. Again, especially with 0% interest rates, and who knows, we might get negative interest rates here sometime in the next 12 months.
Can you imagine that? I mean, the Fed is buying up the market right now, right? They're actively, I understand it's like, is BlackRock involved or anything like that? Or are they actually buying up the securities, or are they just doing the mortgages again?
They're buying up and propping up, vast swathes of the market. They went further or have gone further than previously, certainly in the financial crisis, and not just providing support to banks, but actually buying corporate bonds, first through ETFs, but then now they're buying directly corporate bonds. So really kind of propping up vast sectors of the economy. And that's kind of unprecedented. We haven't seen that before. Mm-hmm. And obviously, people will be familiar with some of the programs that were put in place where the government was actually giving money directly out to individuals. So there's been all sorts of measures, really unprecedented measures. We keep using that word. to describe what's happening because it's very difficult. Certainly in peacetime, there is no precedent for it.
Interesting. Now you came, I can tell from your accent that you're not from New York. You're in the United States now, but what's kind of your history? What was your, what countries do you work in and what are your favorite places?
Yeah, so I'm from Scotland and I'm from a city on the northeast coast of Scotland called Aberdeen. And I grew up there. I went to college in England and went to university at a place called Bath, which is in the southwest of England. And then after college, I went to London, which is obviously our capital city in the UK. You know, it's our New York, if you will. And went into the finance sector, started with banking, and then got into asset management and was there for the best part of sort of the half of my career. And then with a previous company, I moved to New York to set up and run their US business for them. And so that's what brought me to the States. And I've been in New York really ever since. So now it's been 11 years, my 11th year. So they say after 5 years, you're a New Yorker. So in that context, I certainly have done my share.
How is New York right now? So people listen to these things all year, but it's like we're right after the pandemic, kind of we're at the latter ends of June. But how is New York?
I think things are getting better. I mean, clearly, as things start to open up, things will hopefully return to normal. But it was pretty bad for a while, as you know. And, it was really that double whammy of, first of all, the pandemic. And it was, it was a very strange experience. Certainly someone like myself, that comes from a foreign country, the city that never sleeps. You watch all the movies about New York. You kind of know it so well, even if you've only been there. Maybe you've never been there, but you know it well enough already. And to see no shops open, no restaurants open, no bars open, no people on the streets. It was very, very strange. And then obviously the civil unrest that kind of came after that was sort of equally as scary. So it certainly has been a really bad few months. But hopefully now things are starting to open up and kind of get back to normal.
Hopefully we do. It seems like the market doesn't really, it shrugs off everything and says, I'm going to keep going up.
Yeah,
I think you called it the wall of anxiety or something.
That's right. It's the phrase I've used before is climbing the wall of worry. So everybody's terrified that the market's going to collapse at any moment, but yet we keep grinding higher, and that's called climbing the wall of worry. And this is really something that it's almost counterintuitive in a way, but it's the same playbook that really happened after 2008. And if you can remember, 2008 was such a shock to the system. Everybody coming out of there said, I'm not buying the market. No way. The economy's finished. There's no way we can invest right now. And of course, exactly the wrong thing to do was to do that. And the market went up and went on a, 10-year bull market or 11-year bull market. And, now I think we're seeing the same thing, which is the market collapsed in March. The government stepped in with, a huge amount of stimulus. And, that has really, fueled this rally just like we saw in 2008. So I think that certainly, providing that the government are willing to kind of backstop this and, put their full, faith and support behind the stock market, we'll continue to see, higher prices from here.
I don't recall ever seeing the Fed step in like they've done. I've never seen a president push and focus so like glaringly at the market and using that as a litmus test before. And it was really interesting. Like you kind of knew it was going to bounce back. We were looking at it saying, hey, maybe 6 months tops, but what do we know? We just looked at it and said, it seems like they're going to try to do everything they can to get this back. And boy, it is just taken off again.
Yeah. If you think of the market almost like a business. So if you take the whole market and say, well, if your business, you've got, revenue that's coming in, you've got revenue coming in from all sorts of sectors of the economy, and suddenly you just shut that sector down or shut that economy down. Mm-hmm. Then as a business, now you have to make up for that revenue that you've lost, all the revenue from airlines, all the revenue from cruise ships, from hotels, from all sorts of areas of the economy. So that's what the government's trying to do, is step in and try and backstop some of that lost revenue that clearly has been lost as the economy shut down. So hopefully as things start to open back up again, we're able to recover and get some of that back.
We just have to pay for it all now.
That's right. Nothing comes for free, unfortunately. There's no free lunch.
Yeah, just wondering what's going to happen because they printed so much cash. So it seems to me, and again, I'm a neophyte, you're professional at this, that you're going to have inflation or you're going to have something.
Yeah, I think the big difference, now that I think people are talking about that is different from last time is, although we printed a lot of money last time, and there was certainly a lot of people concerned about inflation, it was also, from a fiscal perspective, the banks never put that money into the market because it was a banking crisis. And yeah. So, the money was given to the banks. The banks didn't distribute it. So it never trickled down. You would have heard that phrase used a lot into the economy. This time it's different because the government, they want to encourage as much investing, as much money flow as possible, much liquidity as possible into the market, into the economy. And so I think this is different, that you've got willingness on both sides of the aisle, both political parties, to support stimulus. Again, it was funny because I was looking at some of the political polls, given that we're coming up to a presidential election, at the end of this year. And it's worth remembering that last time around in 2008, the majority of people on the Republican side were actually opposed to stimulus. Remember such a thing as the Tea Party? That's gone. And actually now both political parties, stimulus all the way. The median voter shifted to the left. The median voter is the one that's making is the price maker, if you will, and the politicians are the price takers. And so, that I think is fueling this stimulus. And from that perspective, seems like that's what people are willing to do. And, if that continues, you have to think that there's probably a higher chance you get inflation, certainly a weaker dollar, which is why a lot of people are interested in gold.
Yeah, seems like it makes sense. And I just look at it like the last time, it seems like you gave the bad actors the money, the banks that arguably got us into a lot of the troubles in the meltdown that were pushing the mortgages and everything else, ended up getting the money and they kept it.
That's right. I think there's a moral hazard, because clearly the moral hazard last time is, as you say, the people that had caused the crisis ended up benefiting from it, but it was really confined to bank. I mean, some people will obviously argue that Detroit and other parts of the economy, there were special cases where people got bailed out that shouldn't have. But for the most part, it was banks. This time around, clearly, it's been much, much more than banks. And I think for the most part, people haven't blamed any companies or any sectors. It's just been, something that this is a health crisis.
They're blaming China now. They like to blame China.
But I think what it does is it creates moral hazard across, because you're now going to get more zombie companies that, maybe it was a business that wasn't doing particularly well before the crisis, but the crisis just kind of pushed them over the edge. And so some people, as we've seen, have gone bankrupt, but there'll be a lot of companies that will continue to exist just by shuffling around borrowed money. And that's not particularly healthy for the economy.
Got to be careful. That's again why you got to use common sense in this thing and not just follow the herd. What was the company of Hertz that was going bankrupt and everybody's buying it?
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous behavior.
Explain what bankruptcy means to them.
Yeah.
You're not going to get anything.
Yeah, this sort of phenomenon of these ultra speculative scenarios where, like you say, you have Hertz, which was in trouble before the crisis, but the crisis really pushed them over the edge and the company is bankrupt, but yet the stock still continues to trade. And I think at one point they traded back above their previous high market cap just on pure speculation. It's just crazy.
Yeah, maybe they get bailed out by somebody somehow, some way, and I don't see it. But then again, the markets have never really followed much logic in my brain. I always look at it and say, sometimes it seems pure emotion. And do we have a lot of the new day traders, the ones trying to get rich in a quick, get rich quick? I'm going to make some pretty aggressive trades and hope to benefit from it. Is that what you guys also see?
Yeah, I think that's been a big part that has gotten a lot of publicity. That there tends to be a lot more speculative activity, and I think that's largely because a large part of the institutional market has kind of been absent from this recovery. And we've seen some of the most famous investors in the world, standing up and sort of publicly saying, hey, we were wrong. We missed this. We didn't see this recovery coming, or the stock market, coming back so quickly. And I think for until now, the retail investor, those kind of speculative day traders have been very active in the market by all accounts. So there's certainly something that typically happens when you get a market that's a bit frothy, is you get much more speculative activity.
Very volatile, scares the pants off of me. I would never want to, I could never be a day trader. I could never gamble either. I live in Las Vegas and I'm miserable. If you sit me at a blackjack table, I can't wait to get away. Not my thing. I really appreciate you coming on. I would love to, I know that we talked about having you come in and do some more deep dive on the income producing. I would love to do that sometime. It's really cool to get to talk to somebody who puts these things together, because a lot of people think it's, it's some weird dark corner of Wall Street, and they're like, here's what we're going to offer out. And it's guys like you that are putting these things together with your company, creating. Yeah. And I love the way you said it's a recipe. You're following a recipe, you're following rules, and you're applying those rules, and you're transparent about what those rules are. So anybody could look right over your shoulder, and you're not beating them over the head saying, like a Madoff. You said, hey, I got the secret. I have the secret trading function. That's how I'm getting these huge returns, right? You're not playing that. You're saying this is exactly what we're doing.
Completely transparent. And fundamentally, it's an ideas business, meaning that we're only as good as the investment ideas that we create. And again, in a pure capitalist system, there's nobody propping us up. If we launch funds that people don't want to buy or that they think are rubbish, then we're not going to be around. And so it's a pure ideas business, just like any good, manufacturing company should be, which is you've got to produce things that capture people's imagination and that, create a real need. And that's hopefully what we try and do.
That's absolutely fantastic. Love having you on. William Rind, Granite Shares, they can go look you up. You have a website, I assume.
We do. Yep. GraniteShares.com. Just the way that it sounds, all one word, granite like the rock, shares.com. And then we also are on LinkedIn, on Twitter, just at Granite Shares. So hopefully we're pretty visible, but please, please come and ask us questions and reach out to us anytime.
Fantastic. Thanks, William.
Thanks, Toby.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.